Well, John opened his epistle by saying what we have seen and heard and our hands handled concerning the word of life, we proclaim to you. So it's a message that he's proclaiming. But John realizes that there are other messages out there. His is not the only one. And we're going to look at chapter 4 opens with how we deal with competing messages. How do we evaluate the information and the messages that are coming at us in the world? How do we sort through all that? He ends chapter 3 saying, "By this we know that he is remaining in us through the Spirit which he gave to us." And he picks up on this word spirit and runs with it. "Loved ones, do not believe in every spirit, but rather judge the spirits, whether they are out of God, because many false prophets have come out into the world. By this you all know the Spirit of God. Every spirit which agrees that Jesus Christ has come in a physical body or in the flesh is out of God. And every spirit which does not agree with Jesus Christ is not out of God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, whom you've heard is coming, and he's in the world already. You are out of God, little children, and you have conquered them, because the one who's in you is greater than the one in the world. They are of the world, and on account of this, they are speaking out of the world, and the world is listening to them. We are out of God, and the one who knows God is listening to us. The one who's not out of God is not listening to us. Out of this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error." This word spirit can be taken multiple ways. One is the reality that there are personal spiritual beings, God, Satan, demons. Another way is the concept of a spirit, the spirit of the age, the spirit of 76 or whatever, you know, a certain mindset. Or spirit is also, we use that to refer to the non-material part of our soul. These three concepts all flow together here. There is a spiritual world which is pitching ideas. There are human spirits which are receiving and acting upon these ideas. And there are bodies of teaching which are being taught by these people. And they're all related. So the different meanings for spirit flow together in different places in this passage. It's colored more in one direction than another, but they're all related. "Every good or evil inclination is called a spirit," wrote the Puritan John Cotton in his commentary on 1 John. It says it always comes from some spirit of the world, of the devil, or of God. So what are the spirits, these belief systems, which come from human souls and spiritual beings? What are these mindsets, these spirits which are being promoted around us? We live in an age which is full of messages. I thought I would just go to Google News and see what the type religious news, and thought I'd see what are the first 10 hits here. The top one was a link to a Christianity Today article that was just published last month on Independent Charismatic Networks, or Inc. Christianity, as they called it. They say it's one of the fastest growing faith groups in the United States. Apostles like Bill Johnson, Mike Bickle, Cindy Jacobs, Chuck Pierce, Che An claim millions of followers. Many of these apostles run megachurches. Bethel Church in Redding, California, International House of Prayer, Kansas City. But their real power lies in their innovative approach to selling faith. They've combined multi-level marketing, Pentecostal signs and wonders, and post-millennial optimism to connect directly with millions of spiritual customers. And that allows them to reap millions in donations, conference fees, and book and DVD sales. And because these Inc. apostles claim to get direction straight from God, they operate with almost no oversight or accountability. That's a church just probably the nearest megachurch to us right there. Hit number two, Rastafarian pot farm shootout. Rastafarian would be a definite departure from Christianity. That's where they've taken some Christian ideas and merged them with voodoo and spiritist religions. Smoking drugs, a spiritual thing to do. There are many people that are saying so. Also in the top ten was a Huffington Post story on the political theology of Trumpian evangelicalism, which said all of us evangelicals have a theology in which God sides with the ones who are most powerful and the end justifies the means. That's what we believe, right? Also, I was intrigued to find in the top ten that vegetarianism is the what the experts recommend, at least in India. All kinds of messages. You know, the Bible does have something to say about that. I think Paul calls it doctrines of demons, vegetarianism. We are in an age where there's tons of ideas being thrown at us. How do we evaluate them? I was in my formative years in the 1980s. Neil Postman wrote a book called "Amusing Ourselves to Death," and very, very insightful. I don't know if he's a Christian or not, but he had some dead ringer insights about where our culture was going. And you know, in the 80s, I don't think most of us had any idea of where, but now we see it 30 years later, 40 years later. But Postman saw it in the 80s. As a culture moves from orality to writing to printing to televising, its ideas of truth move with it. An oral culture where everything is transferred by word of mouth looks very different. The kinds of people that live in that kind of culture have certain characteristics. The kind of people that operate primarily in print, that kind of culture has certain characteristics. And a culture that operates primarily by visuals, video and photography communication has certain characteristics. As he said in his earlier book, the medium is the message. The way that information is transferred actually influences what is being said and controls what is being said. Television's way of knowing is uncompromisingly hostile to typography's way of knowing. Television's conversations promote incoherence and triviality. Television speaks in only one persistent voice, and that's the voice of entertainment. Now, he was writing this before the internet. Television, in other words, is transforming our culture into one vast arena for show business. Thinking does not play well on TV. There's not much to see in it. How long would people watch someone doing this? It doesn't have appeal, does it? You're not gonna see that on much, you know, but for a second on TV. TV aims for applause, not reflection. It must suppress content to accommodate visual interest, and that's key. It must suppress content to accommodate visual interest. TV sets the format for all discourse, then. Americans exchange images, not ideas. Snapchat. We argue using good looks and celebrities, not by using propositions. Well, isn't that how the U.S. presidential debates were done? It's a very different way of thinking and communicating. And Postman says, Americans are the best entertained and least informed people in the West as a result of abandoning the Reformation orientation towards the written word. And then he closes his book with this very insightful warning. There are two ways by which the spirit of a culture may be shriveled. In the first, the Orwellian, thinking of Orwell's book, 1984, culture becomes a prison. In the second, the Huxleyan, Huxley's Brave New World, culture becomes a burlesque. What Huxley teaches is that in the age of advanced technology, spiritual devastation is more likely to come from an enemy with a smiling face than from one whose countenance exudes suspicion and hate. In the Huxleyan prophecy, Big Brother doesn't watch us by his choice. We watch him by our choice because he's so entertaining and keeps us, you know, keeps us numbed. When cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainment, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, when, in short, a people become an audience, everything is videotaped or video-fed, their public business becomes a vaudeville act, and a nation finds itself at risk. Culture death is a clear possibility. That is the reality we're living in right now. One of my favorite films produced by veteran Hollywood producer Barry Levinson in 1990. It's entitled Avalon. It didn't sell well because it had a lot of this in it. But he clearly attributes the breakdown of the American family to the development of video entertainment in this movie. In one of the most poignant scenes at the end of the movie, the main character reflects back on his life. He says, I went to see the house on Avalon. And it was gone. Not just the house, but the whole neighborhood, gone. The grocery store where we used to shop, it's gone. All gone. I went to see where we used to live on Poplar Street. It isn't there. Not even the street. It isn't there. It isn't there. And then I went to see the nightclub I used to run. And thank God it was there. Because for a moment, I thought I never was. And in this movie, Sam Kaczynski's home, his precious family culture as well, did not endure. And all that endured was video entertainment, was the entertainment of the age. That was the only thing that endured. The 80s Christian rock stars that I listened to also picked up on these themes. Amy Grant's blockbuster album, Unguarded, she sang, don't take a ride from a stranger, no way to tell where they go. How can you learn what is true and just? How to know who to trust? Here comes a man with a scam to sell. How can you tell? Everyone will have their words to say. They're going to hit you from all sides. Better make up your mind who to, who not to listen to. And there's also the more briefly popular new wave band Farrell and Farrell, which I liked a lot. How much do I learn from people in a box? Speaking of the TV. They seem so worldly and so welcome to the eye, and they told me what to wear, how to smell and do my hair, and how to charge the new car I'd be buying. I just sat and soaked it in. All these people are my friends? It never dawned on us that they could all be lying. And are these sultans of video activity truly the masters of my destiny? Was I made in the image of Trinitron? Did Jesus ever endorse mediocrity while we consume hours of programmed philosophy? Will we ever learn off is as easy to turn as on? Now, that dates me. I can't roll out the latest pop phenomena. But jumping from the boxy TV to pocket LCD screens has not improved things. It has just made video watching more socially isolating due to the small screen size. Every video, every song, every game, every show, every media has a spirit behind it. a message that it's promoting, an idea. And every idea has consequences. Ideas result in a broken down family or a family built up. They result in a socialistic economy or a capitalistic economy. Ideas result in totalitarianism or liberty. Ideas result in isolation or community. Ideas result in faith in Jesus broken down or faith in Jesus built up. And they result ultimately in eternity in the lake of fire or eternity of pleasure at God's right hand. And that's why it's so important to evaluate every idea that's coming into your head. Capture it and put it where it belongs. I'm not saying that media is bad, that you have to burn your iPhones or whatever. What I'm saying is that you must bring entertainment, you must bring all that video under submission to the Lordship of Jesus Christ and make it do His will and not let it run you. Hitler's public relations team in Nazi Germany understood well that if you proclaim a lie loud enough and long enough, people will believe it. And you, too, will believe it. You no doubt have already been taken in by lies of people who follow that tactic. You will be hoodwinked financially. You will be hoodwinked politically. You will be hoodwinked spiritually if you do not guard the door of your mind and evaluate what's coming into it. I was personally startled a few years ago when I watched the movie Time Changer, where a man from the 1900s is shocked and scandalized as he sits in a movie theater and hears an actor take the name of the Lord in vain. He jumps up and demands that they stop the movie. And when I saw that, I realized, you know, that never crossed my mind to do such a thing. I'd demand the movie be stopped. Well, I mean, I'm just used to actors taking the name of the Lord in vain. I don't feel like it's a big deal anymore. And I realized I'm the frog in the kettle. I didn't notice how how dangerous the water around me that I live in has gotten. What can we do about it? What can we do about this living in the middle of a culture that is proclaiming all kinds of messages? Well, John says what we must do in verse 1. He states it in the negative, don't believe everything. And in the positive, judge the spirits. Prove them, test them, try them, examine them, scrutinize, judge, discern, evaluate. This Greek word, dokimazo, is used in the context of testing a metal. Take that metal ore. What color is it? Does it have an odor? What's it feel like? You use all the tests to figure out what kind of metal it is. God commands us to judge. This is the command that rules chapter 4. Judge. Now, that may not be what a lot of other Christian groups are telling you. They're focusing on judge not. But God commands us to judge. That is a Christian thing to do. Christians are to be a discerning people, noticing what is of God and therefore to be embraced, especially love, right? And noticing what is not of God and rejecting it, especially the false teachers, the antichrists. Notice who is this command addressed to? Y'all, the eta ending there at the end of that verb, dokimazeta, is second plural, y'all. Not the pastor, the pastor's included, but we must not simply rest upon the judgment of the pastor. We all must judge. And that judgment must be done with the mind by objective criteria. we need to search the Scriptures daily so that we can understand how to try the spirits. Try our own heart, too, with it. John gives us a reason to be diligent in testing the spirits to determine their origin. It's because many false prophets have come out of us and out into the world. The Old Testament stories tell us of several occasions where many false prophets were pitted against one true prophet. Micaiah was one of them. And the song before the sermon we just sang, Elijah facing off against 451 prophets of Baal. Things are still the same today. It takes discernment to clear through the din of voices of all the false prophets who are teaching lies. It might look like a sheep, might look harmless, but if it's a wolf wearing sheep's clothing, we need to identify it before it eats us. There's a definite link between the false prophets and the Antichrist. They've both gone out from the church, and they're both in the world. The devil, too, has left his place in heaven to roam the earth. The perfect tense of the verb have gone out, have gone, indicates they're still at work. These men, preachers, religious leaders of whatever sort, teaching error. We must evaluate the messages. And John gives us three criteria by which we can evaluate. One is their confession. What do they teach, especially concerning Jesus? Second, who's listening to them? What's their audience? And third, their actions. Is love characteristic of them? So I want to look at these three points and then try to apply them in some modern contexts. The first test then is the confessional test. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit which agrees that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh or in a physical body is out of God. And every spirit which does not agree with that is not out of God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist. The spirit that checks out is out of God. This phrase, ek tu theou, out of God, means the spirit was part of God, came out of him and into us, or perhaps in reference to the children of God, the verb born is to be understood, born out of God. The spirit, or begotten out of God, the spirit that does not confess Christ did not come from God, comes from some other source. The parallel structures of verses 2 and 3 make this confession, Jesus Christ having come in the flesh, the obvious expansion of the one word Jesus, if you just have that one word Jesus in verse 3. Most Greek manuscripts actually expand it out in verse 3 to say the same that verse 2 does, but they're saying the same thing. The spirit of the Antichrist is an attitude, a mindset, a complex of ideas. And it exists in the world today in every heresy and non-Christian religion. Perhaps especially in our culture, in the religion of secular humanism, or its brainchild, democratic socialism. Some questions that are related to this. Do they believe that Jesus is the Christ? Jesus Christ has come. Remember, we looked at the meaning of that word Christ last week. It means the one that's anointed. The one that's anointed is the one who is the ultimate priest connecting man with God. He's the ultimate prophet connecting God, communicating God's words to man, and is the ultimate leader that we follow. When you're presented with an ideology, what do they believe that Jesus is? Do they promote him as the Christ, the ultimate connection between man and God and our authority? Or do they present him as something else? The Mormons present Jesus as someone that you can replace. Once you reach your ascended state or whatever, you become Jesus and you no longer need to go through Jesus to get to God. You will relate directly to God. And you will become the mediator between God and the men, the spiritual children that you spawn. That's Mormon ideology. And by this confessional test, Mormonism is a false religion. Do they verbally agree that Jesus is fully God and fully man? That he came in flesh, not into flesh? That the our prepositions even are very important. And John uses the preposition in flesh, not into flesh, because he's not a hollow human filled up with a deity that came and went from it. Jesus was fully God and fully man at the same time. God incarnate in flesh. This would specifically challenge some of the ideologies that were going on in John's time, that were trying to separate the human from the divine and say, well, God wasn't really both. Jesus wasn't really both. He was somewhere in between. And so it kept Godhood and the physical world and the spiritual world separate, which was part of the Gnostic and Greek traditional thought. Do they believe in the continuing effect of Christ's first coming? He came to do away with sin. He came to destroy the works of the devil. Is he still destroying the works of the devil? Or did he leave us? Like some of the deistic religions would believe that he's not involved right now. Does their walk match their talk? Do they love as Christ loved? You know, some of the there are religious groups today that are very big about tolerance. And we've just got to let everybody believe what they want to believe. But you Christians, you can't believe what you want to believe, but everybody else can believe whatever they want to believe. It's hypocritical. If their talk doesn't match what they are walking, if they're preaching tolerance, but they're actually intolerant of Christianity, there's hypocrisy going on there. They're not matching. You know, for some people, it's just they don't really mention Jesus. But Gordon Clark, who was he was big on logic. He wrote a textbook on logic, and was a professor, I think, at Butler University, the chair of the philosophy department there, and is a Christian philosopher who died a couple decades ago. But he noted, you know, John states this both in the positive and in the negative. If he had simply left it at every spirit that confesses Jesus is of God, it wouldn't necessarily rule out the logical possibility that some spirits who do not confess Jesus might be of God. But the negative conjunction in verse 3 narrows the field so that there can be no middle ground. There are only two camps. One is the us who are out of God, influenced by the spirit of truth, and the opposite camp are the them who are of the world and influenced by the spirit of error, the spirit of Antichrist. So here's the first test. It's a confessional test. What is the doctrine they're teaching concerning Jesus? The second test John brings up is one of association. Verse 4, you are out of God, little children. You've conquered them because the one in you is greater than the one in the world. They are out of the world. And on account of this, they are speaking out of the world. The world's listening to them. We are out of God. The one who knows God is listening to us. The one who's not out of God is not listening to us. Out of this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. It's two camps. They and we, which also includes you, the second test of the spirits is their audience. The you, the they, and the we, first words in verses 4, 5, and 6, are emphatic in Greek. That's why I capitalized them in my translation. The Antichrist Gnostic false teachers were pitted against John and his apostolic band. The antagonism is strong here in the Greek grammar. The they are false prophets. They speak as from the world. That's going to refer back to the confession test. They speak from a worldly point of view. the moral characteristics of the world order as separated from Christ. And the audience, too, is a distinguishing characteristic. Who is drinking in the teacher's message? If the world is listening to the message of someone, there's a good reason to question whether that person's message is of God. If true Christians are paying attention, then maybe we should listen up, although that's not a fail-safe test. Lots of Christians are indiscriminate and fill their minds with all kinds of stuff. We can also test ourselves. Are we drinking it? Which audience, or which teacher are we paying attention to? Which audience are we in? Are we drinking in the Bible, or is our mental diet worldly media? Knowing God results in a knowledge of truth versus error, and that results in discerning whether a teaching is from God or Antichrist. John is saying that Christians should listen to him, not the Antichrists. Today we should read the Bible rather than filling our minds with the stuff of the world. Our knowledge of God and our judgment tells us what is worth listening to. There's a contest going on for listeners. There's a contest going on between two messages from two different sources. But the outcome is already decided. You have conquered them. Perfect tense. Have conquered. Indicates the victory was achieved in the past by Jesus on the cross. It hadn't been challenged since. We have overcome the world. The world which is influenced by the evil one. That evil one's also been overcome, right? Chapter 2, verse 13. The reason we overcame the world is because the spirit which God gave to be in us is greater than the spirit of the world. Gordon Clark, writing in the late 1900s, said, "The false prophets have captured the major denominations. They control the press so that we are constantly misrepresented and ridiculed. Yet John's words are true. We children of God have conquered the false prophets. They failed to convince us of Velthausen's higher criticism." That's the secular assumption that the Bible was written as a collection of stories and trying to decide which of those stories are true and false. That's higher criticism. There is a lower form of criticism which simply compares the words of different Bible manuscripts. That's a valid science. They failed to convince us that there was no Hittite nation. That was one of the sticks that they used to beat Christians with in the 1800s, was the Bible talks about Hittites. Nobody's ever seen a Hittite in archaeology. That's just made up in the Bible. And then somebody discovered archaeological evidence of the Hittites, and that argument had to go out the window. They failed to convince us that the Pentateuch was written after the Babylonian captivity. Why? Well, because there's so many prophecies that came true in the Babylonian captivity and afterwards that the secularists said, well, it must have all been written during the exile or during the Reconstruction because they couldn't have had true prophecies back then. We still believe in the virgin birth, the atonement, and the resurrection. Of course, that's a Presbyterian minister speaking after the Auburn confession, which said Presbyterian ministers don't have to believe in those things, the virgin birth, the atonement, resurrection. We've conquered them, and the witches and the Presbyterian movement, that's how the PCA and the OPC and the EPC, CPC, CREC, all those denominations started in the late 1900s as a form of regaining those orthodox points of theology in the Presbyterian movements, and we see that in other Christian traditions as well. In the 21st century, we've got our own messages, ideological battlefronts that we are facing. Religious tolerance, same-sex marriage, maybe a couple of them. Who knows what all else is going to happen? We're just still at the beginning of this century. No matter how strong, however, the forces appear to be on the side of error, the Holy Spirit is stronger. God's truth will win out in the end. But notice, it's not you by your power that's going to win out in the end. It is the one in you who is greater than the world, not you. And Augustine, in his sermon on this text, had a good reminder. He said, Why have you overcome? Because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. So be humble. Bear your Lord. Be thou the beast for him to sit on. Good it is for you that he should rule and he guide. For if you don't have him to sit on you and guide you, you're going to be a wild donkey and you'll be sent out among the wild beasts to be devoured. So in addition to the criteria of confession and audience of a spirit or a teacher, we can also judge them by the presence or non-presence of love. And this isn't explicitly stated here, but it is nevertheless in the context, both before and chapter 3, verse 13, he who does not love abides in death. And afterwards in verse 7, everyone that loves is born of God. Augustine wrote, all those who violate charity or love deny Jesus Christ to have come in the flesh. This goes back to the confessional test. For Jesus had no need to come, but because of charity. If he didn't, God so loved the world, he sent his Son. As indeed the charity we are commending is that which the Lord himself commendeth in the gospel. Greater love than this can no man have than a man lay down his life for his friends. How was it possible for the Son of God to lay down his life for us without putting on flesh in which he might die? Therefore, whosoever violates charity, let him say what he will with his tongue, his life denies that Christ has come in the flesh, and that is an antichrist. If they don't have love that's laying down itself, then say what he will, he fails the love test, even if he might pass the confession test. Augustine further applied it to how love creates an attitude of forgiveness instead of revenge. When somebody does something wrong to you, what will the people of the world say? They'll give advice like, are you going to let her get away with that? Or you ought to make him pay for that. They that say such things, said Augustine, of the world they speak, and the world listens to them. None say such things but those that love the world, and by none are such things heard but by those who love the world. And you have heard that to love the world and neglect charity is to not deny that Jesus came in the flesh. Tell me, did the Lord himself in the flesh do that? If, when being buffeted, did he wish to be avenged? If, while hanging on the cross, did he not say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do? Well, if he threatened not, who had the power to avenge, why do you threaten when you are inflated with anger? That would fail the love test. So we have the problem of how do we discern what is the true and what is the false message. The command is judge the spirits, and he gives us these three tests, a confessional association, and an action test. Let's apply this to a few scenarios in the time that we have left. I just went to my spam folder for a few of these. Here's one email I got last week. The Pentagon just went public with a chilling announcement. According to recent interceptions, America is facing extermination within the next 6 months or less. America's stealth enemy has already advanced to stage two and is getting close to giving America the final blow. Security Defense Council just asked Obama to give them clearance to prevent the attack, and watch Obama's shocking response. Click here. P.S. If they don't protect us, we have to do it ourselves and fast. Don't take this lightly. The CIA has already issued a code red in 48 states. Well, in addition to the fact that these people apparently don't realize that Obama is no longer president, it fails all three of the tests. The confessional test. Who is this person looking to for salvation? We have to do it ourselves, he said. No mention of Christ. The association test. Who listens? Who gets wrapped up in conspiracy theory stuff? I have no question that there are conspiracies in government, but the people that get wrapped up in it are people preoccupied by the fear of man, not people who are preoccupied with the kingdom of God. It also fails the love test. Is it loving to spam me and use fear to manipulate me into paying for something? No. All right, how about another one from the spam folder? Have you given Russian dating a try? My name is Anastasia, and I'd love to know your name. I was hoping to talk to you. I believe we have a lot in common. Click here. Well, truth behind this is probably the name's not Anastasia. It's probably a man who sent this message to thousands of people. He doesn't care what my name is and has no idea of what we might have in common. But it fails the confessional test, too. It's encouraging me to commit adultery and violate Jesus' commandments. Jesus is my Christ. It fails the association test. Revelation 21:8 says adulterers will go to hell. That's not where I'm associating. And even though it claims to be about love, it fails the love test. Okay, how about this one? Another one from the spam folder. Decode your destiny. Free numerology reading. Just click here. Well, this fails the confession test. God commanded us not to consult with mediums and spiritists because the source of their information is not from God. There's only one mediator between God and man, and that is the man Jesus Christ. And you want to know what your destiny is? We already read about it in 1 John 3. You will see Jesus and you will become like him because you will see him as he is. That's your destiny. You don't need to go to a numerologist for that. Going back to the independent network charismatics that I mentioned at the beginning, I don't personally know how accurate the article is. It was very critical. And I'm not an expert on Inc. Christianity, but it appears that they are trying to connect to God through a modern-day prophet or apostle. And that fails the confession test because Jesus is the ultimate mediator between God and man. We don't go through another person on earth to get messages from God the Father. We go to Jesus and we can go to him directly. In groups like that, there can be a lot of feeling. I have love and compassion. I've seen that in the IHOP church. But I've also seen that people with discernment, close enough to that movement to see its problems, and have disassociated themselves from it. And I think they did so for good reason. God commands us to judge the spirits, to use discernment. Generally, cult groups prey upon people who do not have their senses trained to discern good and evil. But that is what the Bible says maturity involves. Training your senses through practice of checking things out. Over time, the more you evaluate ideas, the better you get at it. The better you get at discerning good and evil. And that is a mark of maturity. We are all to be growing in that skill, in that spiritual discipline. Loved ones, do not believe every spirit, but rather judge the spirits, whether they are out of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. You are of God, little children, and you have overcome them, because the one in you is greater than the one is in the world. Amen.